Welcome to the Italian Football Podcast with John Solano, Carlo Garganese e Nima Tuvali.
Alright everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Italian Football Podcast. We hope you are doing very well. A lot to get to. We have the Azzurri in Nations League action, like all things being equal in the universe, Earth revolving around the sun, the Italians defeating England. All is right. There is finally, or I should say there continues to be, in this chaotic world and universe, some sense of balance that stays. This is essentially the footballing equivalent of homeostasis. This is how we maintain balance. All things remain the same. So even though they are not participating in a World Cup, Roberto Mancini's man, they beat the English national team once more. So again, all remains right in the universe. Really, no major concerns other than, again, the Italian national team not participating in the World Cup. But yeah, depending on your view of this World Cup, right?
Tiny detail, yeah, right?
Well, that may be, you know, some people like myself, this World Cup really is a kind of a toss away. But whatever, we can get to that. Let's get into everything because a lot happened over the international break. So let's start first, though, with the Italian national team. Okay, so no World Cup. So apparently we need to take these matches somewhat, I won't say too serious, but I guess embrace them a bit more because while everybody is participating in the World Cup, The supporters of the Azzurri who are we supporting?
You can support Iran.
We all need to adopt like an unofficial.
You can support team. Iran. It's done. You need to support Iran. It's done.
You can't live in America and support Iran.
You can. I mean, I'm not trying isn't to get him. Can, I'm not trying to get Canada John. No, yeah, Canada are in the World Cup, but I'm not trying to get John deported to like Guantanamo Bay here. But
they're in the axis of evil, aren't they? In America.
Well, according to the Governor Bush, who started a couple of legal wars. But let's not get into that. But my point is simply that, you know,
I'm already on some sort of list when I receive my ballot in the mail for the Italian elections, which anybody paying attention to the news has.
Oh God!
Little did I know the implications of me submitting that. But anyway, so I'm looking at the list right now. I mean, Canada just has to be. I'm trying to find the most random.
Well, I mean, they're your neighbors, so you can, you know, of course, being American, you can support them.
I suppose. But I'll go with Canada.
Yeah, I'm supporting Iran. I'm supporting Iran.
Brian Cristante too is on Roma, and I believe he's half Canadian. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I will embrace that. Okay, so Italy, they beat England, they beat Hungary. Let's start with the one that everybody, I'm sure, is most interested in. So they defeat England 1-0. Raspadori scoring the only goal of the match in the second half. What did you two make of it? Because when I see them playing like this, I get really annoyed because it is, I won't say blasphemous, but it is somewhat of a comedic joke how they are not in the World Cup, how they, you know, they can go out perform like this, but when it comes to beating the likes of, you know, Sweden, all right, they're not able to do it. But a match like this, they pull it out consistently. So I honestly don't even know how to react. Part of me wants to be mad, and then the other part wants to, again, be somewhat impressed. What did you guys think?
I'm just laughing. Sorry, I'm just laughing because we've got our plan here in front of us, and I've spelt DiMarco's name deliberately with D and Marco in
and
two
it
words
me, because it I know, drives me crazy
because I know that it annoys Nima, and Nima's
it annoys
here
me to the point.
Editing in our Google Doc live, making it one wet because I know it irritates
listen,
so much.
It literally makes me go Michael Douglas and Falling Down. This has been 3 years now, and we've got a segment on him, and it drives me insane. It's not hard to spell the guy's name right. And it's like, it's DiMarco, one word. The only letter that's capitalized is the D in the beginning. Stop it.
Well, in fairness, most people would
look
probably
wrong.
Yeah.
It does look wrong, to be fair.
Well,
they'll probably spell it D-I space Marco.
Yeah, but it looks wrong, man.
Half of the people that live here, they don't have vowels to end their surname. So it's, I mean, this is nothing. But in all seriousness.
I'm going to be spelling it like that forever now, just to annoy them.
So,
well, that, you know, so, to be serious though, I thought that
considering the number of players
Italy had out, John, I thought 11 players they had out Italy, at least 11 players who could have played in this game. And you know, to play like they did and deserve to win, be the better team, I thought they, you know, it was fantastic. Yes, it's the Nations League. It's not the biggest competition in the world. But you know, it is considering Italy are out of the World Cup and it is a trophy. You know, I think Italy have done amazingly well to come top of the group. In the England game, there was lots and lots of positives. You know, some youngsters played. You know, DiMarco, we've got a segment on him, so I won't go into too much depth about him. He was my man of the match. Raspadori scored a brilliant winner. It was like an Insigne type, Del Piero type goal, wasn't it? From the left, cutting in and curling it. I thought that they were in control of the game, even though England had most of the possession. It was England's possession was all just played around the back. They didn't really concede many chances. I think Donnarumma only really had one save, unlike the Hungary game, which we'll come to. You know, he didn't really, I think he had one double save from Kane. And that was really the only time that England threatened. The Italy defence breezed through the game, the back three. I thought the 3-5-2 worked really, really well. I thought that in these two games, it just gives Italy another option, because one of the criticisms since the Euros is that Italy have become predictable. Teams have worked out their 4-3-3 maybe, and it's just good to have a different option. I'm not saying I wouldn't use the 3-5-2 in every single game going forward, because I think you need to pick it for the right opponent and against the right formation. I'm never comfortable playing a 3-5-2 against, say, for example, a 4-3-3, when that 4-3-3 is being played by a top team. I think it doesn't match up well. But against teams that play the same system, like England were playing a back three and Hungary were playing a back three, I think absolutely it's a good option. And I thought it worked well in both of these games, but especially against England. So I thought I was, yeah, very proud of Italy against England.
What I really like the most is Roberto Mancini's ability to, and this is something that, you know, we also said on the, you know, the questions pod, which we had on Monday, as this is obviously the free one that everyone's listening to, but patrons can always send in questions and on a weekly basis, and we answer them on patreon.com. But yesterday we had a question about this and we discussed this, and my opinion is this, that Mancini's ability to, he's always been criticized for not being able to change things mid-game. But one thing he has been able to do throughout his career is that he's evolved as a manager tactically. When he came through at Lazio and Inter, he played a 4-3-1-2, a completely different kind of football. When he went to Manchester City, he completely revamped and changed. And then he continued that development and change when he came. Then he came back to Inter, he played a different kind of football. And then he went to, you know, Galatasaray. You know, wherever he's been, he's always changed and he's always evolved. And when he came to Italy and, you know, brought on this revolution in Italy, the possession-based, the 4-3-3, you know, why shouldn't Italy, with the players they have a possession-based game and go for it? And they won the Euros because of it. And obviously that was easy, you know, people... because they won, you know, when you're the champ, everybody wants to beat you off your throne. And obviously teams studied Italy. And so now he's showing again that he can change. And the 3-5-2, I think, is really the way to go, because I think it speaks to every aspect of Italy's strengths and it addresses their weaknesses. It maintains the three-man midfield, which I think where Italy are spoilt for choice. It's an embarrassment of riches. And that's really important for the balance and how you construct and build. But what it also does is it addresses two weaknesses. And the two weaknesses are the number nine position, the two striker positions, where Italy don't have, you know, they've struggled demonstrably. and also the back three. Now, what I mean by that is that someone like Ciro Immobile, when he has a Raspadori or a Scamacca next to him, it just looks much more natural. He's used to playing in a back in a two-man attack, and he's always been, that's where he's been, has gotten the most out of himself. But also Raspadori and Scamacca, or when Chiesa comes back next to one of those three, I think will work really well. The second thing is the back three. All of Italy's central defenders, every single one of them, are adapted to playing in a back three. Bastoni's never been better when he's played in a back three. Acerbi's never been better when he's played in a back three. And Bonucci had his absolute peak of his career playing in a back three. So they know what they're doing. And also, when you look at the wing backs, Spinazzola, Udoggi, and even Di Lorenzo, etc., you get the best out of them. So I like this 3-5-2. I really like that. I think the 4-3-3 and 3-5-2 is how he should alternate between them. And that makes Italy difficult, but it also gets the best out of Italy, and it also addresses the weaknesses that this Italy squad has.
I agree on the, yeah, I agree on the wing backs and on the centre backs. I think it will definitely lengthen the careers of some of those centre backs. I mean, even if you take Bonucci, for example, who's been, let's be honest, for most of 2022 has looked really badly on the decline.
Dreadful.
But, you know, absolutely, he was fantastic dreadful in these two games, especially against England. He put on a clinic against England. I mean, England's defense, England's forwards, I mean, they did nothing against him. He completely dominated Kane for pretty much the entire game, apart from that double shot that I just mentioned before. But, you know, some of his long range passing, you know, he did the pass for the goal for Raspadori. You know, he was back to his best. But, you know, even Toloi and Acerbi, I mean, they were so comfortable the whole game, that I think that these players, it will give them a chance to maybe make the Euros. When, you know, one of my doubts was, you know, some of our centre backs, will they be too old at Euro 2024? And I still do have that concern, even in a back three, to be honest with you. But, you know, I think it's good. It definitely worked out well. I thought the wing backs were outstanding in these both these games. I thought they were absolutely fantastic. I see your point on the forwards as well. I do see your point. But, you know, we'll have to see. We'll have to see how they do. Because I still think if there was one criticism from these two games, certainly against England, is that Italy didn't create enough chances. They didn't really create many chances against England at all. And the goal came from just a moment of brilliance, really, from Raspadori. And they didn't really create anything too much clear cut. I think Gabbiadini had a chance on the late in the game. Di Marco hit the post, but apart from that, not too much clear chances. But you know, Italy done well, and you've got to remember, like, England are going to this World Cup as third favourites. I don't agree with that at all. As we discussed on the Q&A episode on Monday, you know, I think that England going to this World Cup, they've repaired things a little bit in the Germany game. They got a draw, they got a recovery that will give them a bit of confidence. But, you know, I mean when you compare Mancini to Southgate, for example, you see the difference that a manager can make, that's, you know, that's tactically, you know, knows what he's doing. And Southgate really doesn't have a clue. I mean, I said on Monday, I've seen more than a few people that have described Southgate as the English Allegri. And that is really what he is. He's just a low block, you know, and then counter attack, and that's all he is. And I think that England they showed in the Italy game, England, that they're full of players who are out of form, like Maguire. And we've got a segment about Maguire and how he keeps getting in above Tomori coming, you know, but also overrated players. And, you know, Declan Rice, for me, the most overrated player in world football. And he showed that in this Italy game. I mean, he got outplayed by Cristante. Sorry, John. No offense or anything. Oh, but it's Cristante. It's not Berratti. It's not, you know, Pete Barella. It's Cristante. And Cristante completely played him off the park in this game. And I just don't rate Declan Rice at all. I know it triggers people that are in England. But, for me, he's just a good player and nothing more. He charges around the pitch, puts tackles in, defends pretty well. He's pretty smart tactically. He screens the defense pretty well, given that. But for a big team, you need a player that can use the ball, that can control the game, can dominate possession, dominate territory, set the tempo, do the short passes, play the short triangles, play on the half turn into the half space, which he's incapable of doing. You know, if you can't do those things, you're not a top midfielder. And it shows, you know.
Yeah, well, let's talk about one of the players that really garnered a lot of attention, and rightfully so, and a guy that I have been on the record as saying I absolutely adore as a player for a variety of reasons, but the technical, not so quick fullback with a ton of technical and tactical awareness are my all-time favorites, which is why Federico Di Marco is one of my favorites at the moment for the Azzurri. I mean, Carlo, as you alluded to, he stood out. He was phenomenal. What do you make of him?
Well, I think Nimmer will certainly give us more detail than me, because I know that Nimmer has been a fan of him for a long time, and a long time before it became popular to be a fan of him. You're now seeing a lot of people jump on the bandwagon now, and you know praise Di Marco. And I'll be honest, I was never hard on him. I doubts I've had of Di Marco are I'm still not 100% convinced how suitable he is in a back four. But there's one thing that there is absolutely no doubt with Di Marco: his delivery, his left foot is world class. I'm not calling him a world class player, of course he's not, but I'm saying his delivery is as good as anybody in world football. If you put him in an area on the pitch, you know, that's in within 30 yards of the goal on the left, he will put it in on a sixpence wherever you want it. He'll put it in the dangerous area. He'll whip it in with pace so you can attack it. And his left foot is unbelievable, whether it's from a cross, whether it's from a free kick, a dead ball, whether it's from a shot on goal, whether it's from a corner. He is as good as anyone in the world with his left foot. And if you can Italy could just play him and put him in a position where he can use that left foot, then he's a huge weapon. And he showed that in these two games.
One would almost say that his left foot is a cheat code, as someone once said.
ding.
3-4. Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, this is what I saw. I mean, it wasn't hyperbole, because I've seen him do this exactly like you said. I mean, my first thing with him was during the 18-19 season, when he was on loan at Parma, and he scored an absolute screamer against Inter at the San Siro to beat Inter. That's when I was like, okay, hang on, what have we got here? And then, of course, he got injured after that, and you know, he came back after the midway point of the Serie A season, and didn't exactly make much fuss at Parma. But we are talking about someone who is born in Milan. He's from Calvairate. It's a quarter in Milan, and his parents have a ortofrutta in Porta Romana, which is like fresh fruit and vegetable shop. He's got a younger brother, Christian, who's also a football player. This kid came up through, he's an Interista through and through, grew up going to the Curva Nord, grew up watching Inter, grew up playing in every level at Inter as just like his brother. He's also from Milan. Now, those of you who are listening to this, you say, well, wasn't Biraghi from Milan? Well, technically not. He's from Cernusco sul Naviglio, which is about 11 kilometers northeast of Milan. Or it's part of metropolitan city of Milan, but not really the city of Milan like Di Marco is. And this is something that I believe is good for every club. You know, the same way that Roma always has, you know, the captain of Roma has to be a Roman guy. I think this is good for Inter and for Milan to have. I mean, Maldini was born and bred in Milan. I think this is good to have players of high quality who are from the city. I think this, you know, that the fans can identify with, and also it's a bridge between the fans everywhere and the squad. But if we're talking about him as a player himself, I mean, like I said, at Parma, it went really, really well. Or it's that goal, and then he was injured and he didn't do so well. And then, you know, he was sent to, he returned to Inter, and Antonio Conte didn't really believe in him as much. He preferred Cristiano Biraghi, which I was a vocal opponent of, because Cristiano Biraghi is not my favorite player in the world. And I'm really disappointed, because Cristiano Biraghi was a player who I actually really wanted to do well at Inter, but he's just simply not good enough. Then something happens, and then he's sent to, on the 31st of January 2020, he's sent to Verona on a loan with an option to buy. And that's when Ivan Juric gets his hands on him, that's when the change and transformation comes. That's when you start to see the player that the development that really, really surprised me and everyone else. And I started taking note, and I watched pretty much every single game of Verona because of Juric and him. And of course, the 2021 season when Inter win the Scudetto, he scores 5 goals, one more beautiful than the other in the Serie A. And I'm really thinking, well, unless, you know, Verona, you have to bring this guy back because he's an Interista and for all the reasons I mentioned. And it is that's the thing. He's not a very tall player. He's 176 centimeters tall. He's not very good in the air. Sorry, 175. He's not very pacey. But what he can do, he's decent in short bursts and sprinting. Yeah. But what he is good at is that left foot. And it's everything from free kicks, long shots, crosses, hard, low, and overlaps to provide those crosses. If you provide him with the right players and the right environment around him, he can really, really hurt you. He can really do a job for you and hurt your opponents. I'm a big fan of this guy.
What does he need to improve on?
He needs to improve on his positioning. Without a doubt, he needs to improve on his positioning because he can still get caught out. And we've seen it Inter time and time again. Understanding and read of the game of when to drop and when to push up. That's still something he needs to work on. He can improve on also if he can, you know, if they can get him to be a little bit more physical. Obviously they can't teach him how to, you know, be good in the air, but he can improve that as well. And also the physical aspects. They're never going to turn.
I was impressed with how he battled in these two games. I thought he showed a good mentality and a good.
Yeah, that's mentality, but I'm talking about the actual physical attributes. You know, he sometimes runs out of gas in games, he's so tired he can barely walk.
The negative in these two games with him is that I've seen it a few times for Inter as well. He had a few bad clearances where just sloppy clearances where he just put it into the center of the field and allowed the opposition to have, you know, counters.
He gets stressed. He doesn't have the experience yet. But I think these are things that you can adapt. He's never going to be a world class. Good in the air. He's never going to be world class in the air, which is also why Simone Inzaghi needs to stop playing him as a left center back. That's something that Ivan Juric did sometimes when teams used to block the wing, and he would want him to have somewhat centrally, have him, you know, run forwards and provide crosses, and teams were prepared for that. But he has to play. He's a wing back. He's a left wing back, and that's his position, and that's where he should be played. And I hope that Simone Inzaghi watched these two games and saw that, because he can hurt Inter. When Lukaku's back, when all these other players are back, when Lukaku's back, especially given his aerial presence that he, you know, the threat that he possesses, he can really hurt teams.
Can I just say one thing, though, before we move on to Raspadori, that, you know, we shouldn't gloss over from the Hungary game. We have to talk about Donnarumma. And it was unbelievable, his performance. I mean, you know, as well as Italy played, you know, they won this game also because of Donnarumma. And I mean, he made absolute miracles in this match. I mean, that triple save for starters, especially the third one of the three. And then the save he also made at 2-0. I mean, absolute miracles. And, you know, he has been criticised since the Euros. Had a bit of a difficult season at PSG, wasn't managed very well with the rotation with Keylor Navas. You know, there were some question marks after the heavy Germany loss in June, where, you know, he made some mistakes, but, you know, he showed in this game, you know, just what a monster he is when he's on it as a shot stopper. Absolutely unbelievable. So he definitely, we have to acknowledge that.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know if it's I won't say that it's certainly a bad thing when you get performances like that, but he really seems, particularly with the Azzurri, more like a feast or famine guy. I mean, I think we would all agree, the less amount he has the ball at his feet, the better, which is also why I think playing three at the back for Donnarumma is... without a doubt should be the priority, because it just fits everybody. And the less you can put the ball at his feet, the better. Just if you turn him strictly into a shot stopper, as you said, Carlo, I think he's phenomenal. But yeah, let's go to Raspadori now. What do you think of him? Because clearly we are moving into a somewhat of a new chapter with the Azzurri, Insigne, Bonucci. Not done, but you would imagine that they're going to start integrating, or Mancini is going to begin integrating different guys, you know, with a view towards the longer term. What do you think of Raspadori? Because, I mean, if you just look at that goal that he took, I mean, so wonderfully taken. He's really starting to turn it on now. Well, we've seen what he's done for Napoli. He's been phenomenal as of late. What do you make of him? Because he's one of those guys where he can just pull that out of his backside at really any given time. I don't think the ability or the skill set is really the question mark with him, right?
Yeah, I think he's as a finisher, I have no doubts, he's an absolutely fantastic finisher. You know, when he has a chance, he hits those bottom corners. He hits the spots. He's a brilliant finisher. Five goals in 15 games for Italy. Pretty impressive, considering he's at the start of his career. Hasn't all, some of, you know, a lot of these will have been substitute appearances. You know, compare it to all the other players they've got. He's probably got a better ratio than everyone else already. So you know, he started well for Italy. I think that there is a lot to improve there. I mean, to be honest with you, I thought he was maybe Italy's worst player against England until the goal. And also when he scored that winner for Napoli. I remember he had an awful game. Was it against Spezia? When did he score the last minute goal for Napoli to win them the game a couple of weeks ago? It was Spezia, wasn't it? Right at the end. And he was dreadful in that game. Like, everything he touched was miscontrolled, and you know, and then he scored the winner with an excellent finish. And, you know, so, you know, I think there is a lot of improvement there. I think he does need to improve, and we saw it again last night. He does need to improve his first touch when he's kind of coming for the ball and then wants to come receive it, play it to someone else. His first touch is not always spot on there. And I'm still not sure, to be honest with you, I'm still not sure what his best position is. I don't really know. I don't know whether he's a first striker, a second striker, whether he's an outside forward, like in a three-man attack, or maybe a bit of everything. I'm not sure, or support. I mean, he also, for Sassuolo, sometimes played as the number 10 in a 4-2-3-1, like the trequartista, in the central trequartista. So, you know, I don't really know what his best position is, to be honest with you. But the technical ability is definitely there. You know, he's both-footed. He's a great finisher. He's got a good shot. You know, he can go both ways. He's nippy. You know, he's got the qualities are definitely there. It's just how he develops. And I think, you know, he couldn't have picked a better place than Napoli. I'm glad he went to Napoli instead of Juventus, because he's got Spalletti working with him instead of Allegri.
Exactly what I was going to say. The fact that you got Luciano Spalletti there, someone who we know is brilliant at getting players, regardless of their age, to take the next step, is, and provably so, is really the right place for him. I'm really happy to see that. And I think the fact that he plays as a right winger sometimes, as a number nine for Napoli, and also for the national team. Look, I think he... I think the 3-5-2 really suits him in the two-man attack. I don't think it's by chance that he scored in both those games. I think right now, in this moment in his career, he needs to have someone else to play off of and close to him up front. Yeah. And I think he can do lots of damage there for Italy.
Well, he definitely needs someone to play off of. Not the most physical of characters, as you could probably tell by one glance at the guy. Actually, I was surprised to see like Sky Sport, or I should say like the UK version. I thought for sure we would get some real gem clips saying how tall and imposing and physical Raspadori could be. And then they pan to him and they see that he's a nano, barely above the height of like Florenzi or something. I was hoping for that, but we didn't receive
He's also a role model for young kids. I mean, I think he studies finance at the university. I think he doesn't have any tattoos. He's always talking about how, you know, you need to.
That's the most boomer thing you've ever
seen. No, but I'm not talking about. I don't care if you're tattooed in the face. I don't care. My point is simply that, you know, he's like an old school Italian footballer in the sense that and off the pitch, you know, he takes care of himself. He takes care of how he presents himself. He wants to be a role model for young players. He doesn't have that kind of, let's say.
Oh, you were tying that all back to his height. At which point
he's not. Let's just say that his personal life is not similar to Nicolò Zaniolo. If we put it that way, he doesn't have that kind of approach.
You're saying he's a clean cut kid, basically.
Yes, he's a clean cut kid. He doesn't, you know, he wants to be a role model. He always talks about how important it is to have the education is, you know, on the side of football and all that. Mm. And he's an interesting.
He's the Gary Lineker of Italian football, only that it's actually real. And it's not.
Yeah, he doesn't own a bar called Lineker's where strippers go out and play.
Well, that's his brother.
That's his brother.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, that he's the financier of that, isn't he? Doesn't he own the bar as well?
I don't know.
That is the most bizarre clip I've ever seen. When they wanted to pay homage to the head of state, the Queen dying, and they bring out these. Well, strippers were playing bagpipes in Spain, and it was just absolutely bizarre.
Okay, moving on. all right, well, Carlo is probably salivating at this one. Let's take it. Tomori versus Harry Maguire, the debate. Or I guess I don't even know why it's a debate. Clearly, I mean...
It makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, if it is a debate in one's own mind, then clearly you are dealing with somebody who is not watching Serie A.
Well, Gareth Southgate clearly doesn't watch much Serie A, although he was in Italy recently, maybe a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
he was at a Roma game, wasn't Roma. He? Yeah. Yeah. And I think he was at a Milan game, or I might be mistaken. I'm for some reason thinking he was at the Milan derby, but I might be wrong. But he was definitely in Italy. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, it's embarrassing, Maguire. And you know, you can't blame him really for being bad in these two England games, because he's not playing for Man United at all. I mean, he's been dropped from the Manchester United team since the second game of the season. I think he's only played one Europa League game since then. And so obviously he's going to be way out of form. Just look at these numbers for Maguire. Did you know that Harry Maguire hasn't won a game in which he started in for either Man United or for England for 10 games? His last 10 matches for Man United and England, Harry Maguire has drawn 3 and lost 7. You know? And he's still and Southgate is still starting. I mean, if that doesn't tell you everything that you need to know about Maguire. And to be honest with you, I thought that Maguire as a footballer, I thought that he's been got a little bit of a hard time for most of his career, ever since he had that big world record move to Leicester in, was it 2019? I think that he's had a hard time, and it's been a bit over exaggerated sometimes. I've always thought he's done, you know, decently. I've never thought he's a top class defender, or obviously not a world class defender, and definitely not the world's best defender or most expensive defender. But I've always thought he's done a decent job, and I actually thought at the Euros, I thought he was very good for England at Euro 2020. And such a big threat from set pieces and with headers, and you know,
he was good in the World Cup as well, wasn't he?
I mean, and at the World Cup, yeah, I thought he did really, really well. But and here comes the but. Last season, he was an unmitigated disaster. For Man United anyway, total disaster. I remember doing a piece on this last season. He had 16 errors last season leading to goals. 16. Just imagine that, 16 errors leading to goals to the opposition. And he's still playing he's still getting picked by Southgate. And when you see that Tomori, who over this international break now didn't get a single minute for England, which Milan will love, obviously. I mean, Milan, Pioli must be absolutely loving that. But I mean, it's a bit of an insult.
He reminds me, for me with Maguire, I think he doesn't work in a back four. I think his strengths are better suited to a back three. And he reminds me a little bit, the mistakes he makes remind me of the absolutely incredibly stupid, hair-raising, annoying mistakes that Andrea Ranocchia used to make over the last decade, especially 5-6 years ago, when when he created a situation that wasn't a situation, unattacked, just on his own, tripping over his own feet kind of thing. That's the kind of stuff that Maguire makes. And he becomes like, and when you see him, he looks big. He's not very technical. He looks a bit clumsy. So he becomes like this kind of easy person to pick on. But regardless, he shouldn't be. I don't understand how Tomori's on the bench. I just don't get it.
The easy to pick on is the mug. Come on, man.
Yes, he does.
He has one of those faces.
You are right. We don't condone bullying for facial expressions, like for our physical appearance here. So don't, let's not.
Well, he's called Slab Head for a reason, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's got a massive head. He does remind me of that cartoon in the 90s, The Head, where an alien used to reside inside of the head of a guy on MTV, if you guys remember.
What character was that?
Well, it was a cartoon on MTV called The Head, I think, and it was essentially an alien moved into the head of this guy, and his head was just
be jumping. Careful when googling that.
Oh, come on, you must remember that. Come on, John, you have to remember that. It was like during the Beavis and Butthead era, and there was a cartoon like when I think it was
can see it now.
I don't know if it was Mike Judge, the guy who did Beavis and Butthead, also drew that, but essentially that's his head. The head,
it looks like a balloon head.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember immediately when I saw him, I was like, yeah, that reminds me of that cartoon. Anyway, we get sidetracked, sorry about that.
Tomori, I mean like, if England play Maguire at the World Cup, I mean, they're just, even your Iran might have a chance. I mean, I'd fancy Taremi and I know Azmoun's not having a good time of things, but I'd fancy them. I'd fancy anyone against Maguire right now. He's so out of form. He's so low in confidence. And you said he works better in a three than a four, which I agree with. I mean, England played in a three in both of these games. True. And you know, so I think it almost doesn't matter what he plays. And he's going to be out, and he's not going to have much match fitness either, because he's not getting back in the Man United team over the next couple of months either.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to some club related stuff. And the first thing here that we have on our plan here, it's written by Carlo. When the introduction to this segment is, did Vlahovic make a mistake going to Juve over Arsenal? You mentioned Allegri earlier. Those two are undoubtedly tied at the hip. You can't take one. You can't bring this discussion into play without considering one of those things. So with that in mind,
isn't that with any Juventus discussion right now?
Jesus Christ! Oh dear.
Well, with that in mind, have at it.
How about it, Arsenal?
Well, I just want to say I didn't bring this up just as a reason to slag off Allegri.
Yes,
I brought this up because you know, there has been a lot of reports going around in the last few days about Arsenal potentially coming back in for Vlahovic in the January market. We know that Arsenal tried to sign Vlahovic in January of this year, 2022. And Vlahovic basically told them he had no interest in going there. He never had any interest in going there. And he only wanted to join Juventus. And he did join Juventus for a lot of money, for 80 million euros. At the time, I think most people would agree and understood why he joined Juventus instead of Arsenal. Because Arsenal have been, you know, haven't qualified for the Champions League in 6 years or however long it's been. And they've always been, didn't really look like they were building anything at the time. You know, now we fast forward 9 months and, you know, Arsenal are top of the league. Yes, okay, they didn't get the Champions League last season, but I think they certainly will this season. They really are building a really exciting young team, playing well. And then you look at Juventus and it's just, well, it's just a total crisis and disaster there for, you know, we've discussed it at length. We don't need to explain why. But I mean, in terms of Vlahovic himself, I mean, you know, you look at number one, how bad the team's doing, and he's thinking, well, am I at the right club? Then you look at him as a player, how is he doing himself individually? How is he developing as a player? I mean, he's got one goal in open play this season in all competitions. since joining Juventus, Vlahovic has got 13 goals in 29 games, which is fine. It's not, there's not nothing bad about that. It's just under one in two. But it's way down. If you look at the numbers that he was doing with Fiorentina, I mean, in 2021, he scored 41 goals in the calendar year, and he scored the joint most Serie A goals in a calendar year for I think 70 years, I think it was. I think the same as Ronaldo. And only Robert Lewandowski scored more goals in Europe's big five leagues in 2021. I mean, this guy was you know, breaking all kinds of records and was establishing himself as genuinely as one of the best strikers in Europe. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. And, you know, I look at how he's done since joining Juventus as a player. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. He has not improved at all since joining Juventus. And actually, I would actually argue that he's actually regressed. He certainly regressed in terms of numbers. I've just given you the numbers. But even like his overall game, in terms of like the weaknesses that he has in his game, haven't improved. I mean, I think his first touch with his back to goal, and his link-up play with others, I think these were areas that he needed to improve, and he hasn't improved them at all. In fact, I think they've regressed. Certainly in this season, he's been really bad with some of his first touches. And, you know, there can only be, here he comes, there can only be one reason for that, and that's Allegri. And, you know, if I'm Vlahovic, I'm looking at playing under Allegri, and I'm thinking, am I under the right manager? I'm 22 years old, and this is a key part of your career. If you don't develop during this time, you don't. It's very difficult to develop later on. And yeah, so if I'm Vlahovic, I'm not saying I would regret it, because Juventus, you know, and you know, he's still young, he's got the career ahead of him. But I definitely would be asking the question: did I make the right choice joining Juve?
Well, can't argue with that.
No, you can't. I still think it's a little bit too soon to say anything, but I think the question does need to be asked. That's especially where Juventus are going in terms of the club as a whole, and it does feel like they're a little bit, there's no direction, or there is this, they've started a direction, but it's not exactly going to plan.
I mean, Milik has been better than Vlahovic so far, in terms of his overall game. I mean, if you take those two brilliant free kicks, and they were amazing free kicks, so you know, that shows, you know, let's not forget
class,
that he scored.
The class of the player is not up for debate. I still think that it's, I think he'll come good for Juve, and I think he will do good for Juve. But I think that it hasn't exactly gone according to plan. No.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. I think he needs just to finish. I think he needs, he needs a new manager at Juventus. If Allegri stays, I think he will risk regretting joining Juventus. So I think, you know, they need a new manager, someone that can get the best out of the attack and help develop him.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think you're going to get much pushback about Allegri's role in this. But anyway, let's move on. We also wanted to bring up the financial stuff related to you.
Yeah, I mean, wow. They beat Inter. Juve beat Inter for the biggest fiscal year loss a football club has made. And this last fiscal year, 254 million euros. That's insane. That is just...
It is.
It's absurd numbers.
How worried should Juventus be? I mean, John is, you know, you're the financial expert here. I mean, how worried should they be?
They shouldn't be worried. Why should they be worried?
I was about to say, I'm not using this as a, well, maybe I am, I don't know. We can revisit that later. But they do have the benefit of some sponsorship advantages on their side. That's probably the kindest way to put it, yeah. I hate to say that a lot of these numbers are just made up, but anything I say, I just harken back to what happened to Barcelona. I mean, we're hearing about the club going down, the, you know, bankruptcy and all this stuff. They go out, they spend how many millions on a 69-year-old Lewandowski? They go out and they spend all this money on Rafinha. At this point, you know, we are basically operating in clown world where it is monopoly money. It's all fake. I mean, anything I say it could be easily, you know, canceled out by just citing one or two examples. Look at PSG. I mean, we've been hearing about them being being at risk for financial penalties. Nothing ever happens. Yes, they were in that recent block of punishments along with Roma, Juve, Inter. But let's be serious. UEFA, FIFA, I'm just at the point where I can't ever believe they would allow anything to happen. What has happened with Barcelona in these last months is nothing short of like criminal, in my opinion. I don't know how a club so close, we're hearing about being so close to bankruptcy. They're selling parts of their media center. And then they go out and they have a spending spree as they did this past summer. Clearly, I know nothing about anything finance related.
While demanding some of their players to take pay cuts at the same time.
Right. Well, right. Yeah. And
withholding money from the coronavirus period as well and deferring the payment to later and they're not paying them while buying other players. I mean.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, we keep hearing all of these excuses as to, you know, coronavirus. Once we get past this difficult period, everything will be back to normal.
But 250 million is a lot for Juventus, a record loss of 254 million euros in the financial year. I mean, that is going to have a big, unless X will come out and bail them out, but will they come and bail them out again? I mean, they bailed them out last year, at this time last year, December. I mean, I can't see them doing it again.
I don't think they will. I think that was calculated. I think they know. That's why they made a cash injection of 400 million. It's like John said, a lot of these numbers are fake and like it's not like it's a loss, but it's also you have to, you know, it could be bigger, it could be smaller. It depends on how, you know, it's a lot of accounting tricks as well, like John said, but it's not a good number. It's absolutely not a good number. And I mean, it's the fifth consecutive year that Juve loses money. I think Inter are up to their 10th, 7th, or 8th, or something stupid like that. It keeps doing this for all these
Thanks,
clubs. it is what it is, and it's the Italian clubs keep losing money, and they can't compete. The TV deal isn't worth a shit. Let's be honest, it's absolutely useless, and they can't market themselves, and you know that just keeps showing. Because they still want to compete at the highest level, they can't afford the highest players, and yet they're the best players in the world. But in order to get at least decent level players, you have to pay high wages, and they can't compete, which is what we've spoken about before. But I mean, obviously, it didn't help with the pandemic. Let's remember that this is also still from this is highly affected by what happened in the pandemic. So yeah, no, it's not good.
Let's move on to Rafael Leão, because Rafael Leão's in contract renewal talks right now with Milan, and it's quite a pivotal moment actually in his future with Milan, because his contract at Milan runs out in June 2024. So we're approaching the kind of the 18 month, you know, away being 18 months away from his contract expiring. And you know, the way that player contracts work in football is that, you know, football clubs generally nowadays try to avoid at all costs letting contracts run down to within 12 months of expiry. You know, in fact, most clubs will always try and do it within 2 years. You don't sign a contract when you're 2 years out, then they're already preparing to sell you. Basically, that isn't always possible, and it hasn't been possible with Rafael Leão yet. But they are in a pivotal moment, and I think if this, you know, if they don't manage to make some headway in the next few months, then they are going to have to consider, you know, selling him for certain. And you know, so we'll have to see what happens. I mean, Paolo Maldini gave an interview the other day where he seemed quite confident, I think, about getting Rafael Leão to sign a new contract. It seems like they're prepared to pay him what he's asking for. He's asking for a big, big increase. I think around about 7 million euros a season. And, you know, so that they're prepared to meet what he's asking for. But we do know at the same time that there is interest from Manchester City, Chelsea, we know, tried to sign him this summer. They bid over 100 million. PSG as well are big fans of him. You know, there are other clubs, big clubs. I mean, he is wanted by the biggest clubs in Europe. So it's I think this is very, very important for Milan because, you know, we know that their project has been over the last few years. After Elliott came in and obviously the state of Italian football, which you just alluded to with money not being in the game like before, you know, they've decided to go with a project of buying young, up-and-coming players, developing them, raising their value, selling them once they've become established for big money, then bringing in the next batch of youngsters to take their place. They're now at this point where they've won the Scudetto, maybe ahead of schedule, maybe you could argue. Yeah. They've won the Scudetto. They've clearly got 3 or 4 or 5 players who have, in my opinion, the ability, the potential to become top class, maybe even world class players, some of these guys. Rafael Leao is one of them, has the potential. Teo Hernandez, Tonali is another. Tomori is maybe another. Mike Maignan, as I said before, I already think is there. You know, they've got 5 there, really, that you can build, you know, a backbone. They're getting to the point where these players are all going to now be wanted by the best clubs and the richest clubs in Europe because they're that good. They're becoming that good. So where do Milan go now in their project? Obviously, money, finances will come into it. But are Milan going to be able to keep these players and carry on building around them? Or are they going to accept, well, unfortunately, we can't compete with the biggest clubs in Europe. And Rafael Leao, we're not going to be able to keep him now. We're not going to be able to give him what he wants or compete with Man City and what Chelsea would offer contractually and financially. And, you know, we go. So, I mean, how do you think Milan should play it? And how do you think it will pan out?
I think Milan are doing this. Well, they can't. What are they supposed to do? They can't do anything more than they have. If he's asking for money that they can't afford, and they need time to see if they can find that money. Obviously, they've been in the middle of a ownership change, kind of partnership coming in, but now obviously Redbird and Jerry Cardinale have taken over completely. But so that was an ideal, and that pushes things back. Now they have to look at things. I think they will do. They will move heaven and earth to extend his contract, but I'm not sure Milan can really afford 7 million net per season. And I wonder if we're not looking at the last season of Rafael Leao in the Serie A. I think I think Real Madrid next summer will come in for this guy. We know that Chelsea and Premier League clubs are really keen on him as well. But I don't think I think Real Madrid, somewhere like a Real Madrid, Man City, PSG, I think that's where he wants to go. That's the natural next step for him in his career. Because he is already, I think, him and Maignan are pretty much world class. You know, there's so much room for improvement with Leao, which is what's so impressive about him. But I think we could be headed to a situation where next summer he'll leave.
Yeah, I do fear that as well, to be honest. I think if Milan don't get him signed up before the World Cup, if he goes and has a fantastic World Cup, and he started the other night, and I think did he score the other night? Or I can't remember. He definitely started anyway. You know, he explodes at the World Cup, then his contract demands and his value is going to increase even more, and then it becomes even harder to sign him to a new contract and maybe prices Milan out. So if they can possibly try and sign him up to a new deal before the World Cup, I think that would definitely be wise. Okay, right. Before we finish off with Baggio and Prem Face of the Week, just a little kind of a hypothetical question here. So we've seen a lot of injuries in the international break, and as we're heading back into the Serie A calendar, and the Champions League will be back next week as well. I mean, Milan have got a hell of a lot of injuries right now, and so have Juventus, and Juventus have had loads of injuries all season. Roma are starting to get quite a few injuries as well, and Inter have just lost Brozovic from the Croatia game the other night. I know Inter are very, very angry about that. So if we can just go through the major teams, who do you think is the most irreplaceable player on each team? We'll go through the major teams. So let's start off with Inter, because, you know, Brozovic here is the one. Is Brozovic the most irreplaceable player for Inter?
Yes. I mean, we've seen that. When he's not there, Inter doesn't work. It's as simple as that.
And he's going to be out for a month, they reckon, right?
So... Yeah, absolutely. Which is they're really pissed off about. So
is that game over for Barcelona then, do you think, pretty much?
Well, unless Cristiano Aslani turns out, you know, all the youth merchants who yell online about, oh, play young kids, play young kids. Well, here's his chance. And I hope he does play. I really hope Simone plays him. And I hope that, with all jokes aside, I really hope they play him. And I hope that he shows that he's mature enough to handle it, because it's going to be difficult. The option is instead to play Barella Calhanoglu or Mkhitaryan or Gagliardini, and Gagliardini is just not good enough at this level. So I think, in all honesty, I'd rather play either Mkhitaryan or Aslani against Barcelona for sure. Gagliardini just doesn't offer anything at all. So it's Brozovic gone is really not what Inter needed.
Okay, Milan. Who's their irreplaceable player, do you think?
I think it's Leao, in terms of, I mean, Tatarusano has done it well when he's replaced. Maignan was injured for last season for a little bit, and they still won the Scudetto and they still delivered results. I think Milan without Rafael Leao just lack and just don't hurt teams in the same way as with him. I think he's absolutely irreplaceable.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've always thought it's Rafael, although then Milan really did impress me, though, against Napoli. And they only lost that game because they were, let's be honest, they were just really unlucky. They deserved to beat Napoli. They dominated much of that game. So, you know, that's why, you know, they supposed to. But then I do think that over a longer period, you know, then it probably does tell, not having Leao over a longer period. I don't think we can judge it just on one game. But I do worry for Milan. They're going to miss Maignan for a month now. Tatarizanu, Champions League, you know, against Chelsea, they could miss him, I think, in that. I just think that Maignan is such a calming influence. But like you said, they did well without him last season. And this seems to be a strength of Milan. They do seem to have a really good team spirit, that when they have players out, they seem to come together and do well. So, yeah, They've answered every question, really, Milan. We'll see how they do with all these injuries in the coming weeks. Juventus, I don't think any of their players are playing well for them to miss anyone right now, but I would probably go with Vlahovic. Yeah, even though, as we said before, he's not really doing very well and he only has one goal. It's just, I think that at the moment, I mean, Juventus just don't create any chances, and They don't have enough goals, enough scorers in their team. I think you take Vlahovic out, and then you're just thinking, well, there's just no goal threat at all on paper, anyway. So I'd probably go Vlahovic.
No, I think it's Vlahovic as well. I think it's Vlahovic, which says everything, really.
Yeah. Okay, Roma, Lazio, Immobile for Lazio, obviously. Roma,
Milinkovic-Savic for me at Lazio. At Roma, I actually think Dybala's pretty irreplaceable for them.
Yeah, maybe. I'd probably go with that right now, anyway. Or Pellegrini. Pellegrini is such an important player. And Fiorentina, I'm going to go for Nico Gonzalez, because I think we saw how they done when he was out.
I think that's a fair shout. Because I don't think Mandragora and Amrabat are yet as important to Fiorentina as they should be, in my opinion.
Yeah. Atalanta, I don't know. I'd maybe go Koop Miners, maybe, right now, as I think he's become such a...
Yeah.
He's become their main man.
I'd go with Koop Miners as well. I think he seems to be the focal point of everything they do.
Okay. Just before we finish off with Badger and Prem Face of the Week, just for everyone, all our listeners that are based in and around London. So next week, next Wednesday, is the Chelsea versus Milan Champions League game at Stamford Bridge. The day before that, on Tuesday, September the 22nd, Milan are actually, they're hosting a free to attend event with the support of Milan Club London, and basically it's a fan event. It will be held at Box Park, Wembley, which is right close to Wembley Stadium. The events, you can find it on, if you Google From Milan to Many fan events, you can find it, more details about it. But it's a fan event, and Alessandro Nesta, the Milan legend, is going to be there. Milan will be bringing the 2021-22 Scudetto trophy for fans to see. And there will be a Q&A with fans, which Alessandro Nesta, fans will be able to ask questions to Nesta. There'll be lots of other stuff going on. There'll be prizes to be won. There'll be screening a historical Milan match, and there'll be lots more. But if you Google From Milan to Many fan event, Box Park, Wembley, Tuesday the 4th of October, you can find more about it. You can register, and it's completely free. So any Milan fans in and around London that want to go, feel free to go. Okay, just to finish off then, Prem Face and Baggio of the Week. Baggio has got to be Di Marco, surely.
Yeah, it can't be anyone else but him, given his performances these two games. I mean, maybe Raspadori, because of the goals he scored, but I think Di Marco's overall performance as warrants it.
Okay, and Prem Face of the Week, we did this a long segment on this on Thursday's show last week, so check that out. Graeme Souness, right?
Yeah, and also it's not a Prem Face as such, but the cringiest ad I think I have ever seen in my life was just released by Calvin Klein featuring Romelu Lukaku. Right. Try watching that without cringing to the point where you start biting yourself. It is beyond cringe. He's sitting there, standing there in a white pair of boxers, looking intellectually into the camera, and they like zoom in on his bulge, and he's talking about, I don't know what, about how hard it was growing up. And it's so incredibly cringe. So that deserves a special mention of its own. It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
But Graeme Souness is the clear winner for his comments on Roberto Di Zerbi.
Yeah, but I mean,
we've got nothing else to add on that.
No. I mean, if we're talking cringe, that Lukaku's Calvin Klein ad is way, way worse. Mm. Watch it and try not to cringe. That's the challenge.
Yeah. Okay, right. Okay, that's all we have time for today. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Our usual Q&A with our patrons went out on Monday, so it's already been published, so check that out. We will be back on
Thursday. Actually, we're preparing an interview episode. We're going to get back to those as well, and those are all going to be free, just like this, the Monday usual show is. And the Thursday review pod, and the question Q&A pod and the post-match reactions and all that stuff is free, is behind a paywall for $2.99 per month ex-VAT on patreon.com/TIFP. And everyone, obviously, if you're listening to this, you know, we really appreciate it. And I got to say this, we've never had as many people listening to the pod on various platforms. So thank you so much for that, Spotify, Google Podcasts, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Big thank you. Yeah. We were averaging over 1,200, I think, listeners.
Yeah, 1,300. Yeah. 1,300. Yeah. We've barely been on from the air, like free for a month. So keep doing what you're doing. Please give us 5 stars and
thank you. Check out our YouTube page as well. Yeah. Which is, we'll just go onto YouTube and type in Italian Football Podcast and look for our green logo. You'll find us. Yeah. That's my boomer explanation of how to find it.
Yes, it is. It really is. It really is. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next time. Ciao, ciao.